Hi there, and thanks for listening to the Adulting is Easy podcast. This is your host, Lauren, and today we're going to make adulting easier by making money easier, as we always do. Before we kick off, please follow my YouTube channel. It's very new, and I'm very close to being able to give it its own Adulting is Easy URL, so please, please, please do that. So I'm joined today by Tesho Akindele, real estate investor, professional soccer player, husband, and a father of two boys. Tesho got his start by investing in long-term rentals in Kansas City and recently added a short-term rental in Denver to his portfolio. He sees real estate not only as a great investment opportunity, but also as a tool to improve society. Thanks for joining me, Tesho.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I've listened to a few of your episodes in the past, and you do a great job on so many different topics. So I'm glad to be here.
Thanks. I'm excited. And before we jump in, I do want to let everybody know that this episode is brought to you by Steadily Insurance. Steadily covers so many different kinds of properties, single family, multifamily, vacant, restorations, apartment buildings, condos, and even manufactured homes. Get this, they also cover, this is for you, Tesho, Airbnbs and VRBOs. So if you are a landlord, if you rent property to others, support this podcast by clicking the link in the show and getting a quote. So our goal for today is to make adulting easier for our listeners by discussing a personal finance topic, since managing money is a big part of adulting. So Tesho, today you and I are going to talk about your first short-term rental. But first, why don't you tell us how you got into real estate investing in Kansas City?
Yeah, so like you said earlier, I play professional soccer. And as everybody knows, you can't be an athlete forever. So I had to start thinking about, well, how can I, to kind of supplement my income whenever I'm like, basically forced to retire at 30 or 35, whatever it is. So, I was kind of looking into the stock market and investing and stuff like that. And then my dad actually is the one who introduced me to real estate investing. I had always been listening to Bigger Pockets, but just kind of casually. And then my dad was like, hey, I met somebody who's buying houses in Kansas City. Like, look at the price of these houses. There was like houses for $50,000 and then you could rent them for $800, $900. And I was like, wow, this seems like a great opportunity. So he went out there, and he kind of got into it and he was like, you got to get in. So I did, I jumped in with him. So he definitely gave me the push, and everything's history, I guess. Since then I've got a few more of those and just kind of kept rolling with my interest and my investing.
That's amazing. And I think, first of all, not everybody listens to their parents, so that's good. That's a good job. I'm sure you are a parent. And then the other side of it too, what I like about what you just said was, as an athlete, you realized you couldn't be an athlete forever. Do you think people around you that are also in professional soccer, do they all get that too? Or we've all heard these stories, I think, about athletes that make their money, blow it, and then have no money. How is that vibe throughout the league?
Honestly, I think a lot of I only play with guys. So a lot of the guys I play with, they kind of don't want to think about their career being over. I'm not sure if people think that, okay, if I'm thinking about it being over, maybe I'm jinxing the here and now, or if it just looks bad, I'm not sure what the reason is, but a lot of people, to be honest, are not really thinking about how am I going to save money for later, or like, what am I going to do after that? They're just really focused on the here and now. And that's important too, because you can make a lot of money being an athlete. So it's important to focus on the now, but that money eventually runs out. So if you spend it all or you have nothing saved away, like one day that spigot is turned off basically, and you go into the world as like, say, a 30-year-old or a 35-year-old with basically no job skills, no money saved, it can be a difficult situation for people.
Right. Yes. That's so interesting. And injuries too, right, can really shorten things for you. So even if your financial plan has you till 35, that might not be right, which is so crazy. For sure. So you started in Kansas City with the long-term rentals, right? You said they're like about $50,000 each, rent for $800 to $900. Those are pretty good numbers. Why get out of Kansas City and go to Denver, but also why do the short-term rental thing?
I have a decent amount of those over there. I have some on my own and some I partnered with my dad on. And I think, it's good, but there's some downsides. Some of those houses are a bit older, so sometimes there's maintenance issues with that. And mm-hmm. The thing that I liked about short-term rentals, which has made me pivot, is you can buy a really nice house and still have it cash flow. So like the short-term rental that I ended up getting, me and my wife are both from Colorado, so it's pretty close to where my wife's family lives in Colorado. So we can use it when we go there. It's a nice neighborhood and it's still going to produce cash flow. That kind of house wouldn't really pencil out if you tried to do it as a long-term rental. So for me, I saw short-term rentals as a way to buy maybe the nicest properties and still, you know, have the numbers pencil out.
I totally agree with you there. And not only can you buy a nice house, you also are more incentivized, I think, to keep it up and keep it looking really beautiful and keeping it really nice. And like you said, the money just wouldn't even be there to do some of those things if you were doing a long-term rental. So that makes a lot of sense. How did it go? How did buying it go? How did setting it up go? What was that process like? Because I think a lot of people that listen are definitely considering getting into this space.
Yeah, well, I guess one piece of advice I'd give to people, and it's something I did, is I contacted a realtor in Colorado she is specifically with short-term rentals. So her whole business is selling short-term rentals and finding people short-term rentals. And she herself has a few that she invests in. So she was a huge wealth of knowledge and resources too. So she like jumped on a Zoom call with me and talked about like what I could be looking for. She gave us a hookup with AirDNA so we could compare properties that we saw on Zillow. She was out there really looking at, oh, I think guests would like this and that while buying the house. So that was a great thing. And her name is Chantal and she's in Denver. If anybody's looking in Denver, she's great. So to find that. And then when we did find the house, we were lucky to get a house that had just been flipped. So everything was kind of replaced and brand new, you know, which is really cool because as opposed to some of the Kansas City houses, which I'm more flipping myself, basically I was buying older houses and kind of redoing them myself. This one was already done. All we had to do was furnish it. And since then, like, nothing's breaking in the house. Don't have to worry about anything because they did a good job on the flip.
It's a good thing they did a good job. I like that they did a good job on the flip. Not all flips are good. And there is something that is a huge relief. When we bought our apartment building last year, it was owned by a contractor and the contractor gutted it when he bought it. Now, granted, he had bought it like 8 or 9 years before, but that's still pretty new kitchens and stuff like that. So, you know, all the guests come in, they're like, you guys have done such a great job. I'm like, kind of just furnished it actually, but I'll take the credit. So do you think that, and I'm wondering if this is going to be a trend in real estate investing, that short-term rentals and long-term rentals should be a part of kind of a lot of portfolios as a diversification play?
Yeah, I think so. But at the same time, everybody should just do kind of what's comfortable for them. You know, at the end of the day, you need to do like what's sustainable in the long term. How you build wealth in real estate or in general is by doing something consistently for the long term. So I would say there's no right answer. It's probably best if you can mix the two, but if you really don't want to deal with short-term rentals and furnishing places, or on the other hand, if you don't want to deal with, you know, tenant leases long-terms, like don't do that, you know, like just do whatever you think you can stick to for the long-term. Buy houses that you're comfortable like holding on to through the ups and downs of a market. And there's no real formula. The only key to success really is like doing it for a long time.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's so many ways to invest in general. And even within real estate, there are so many ways to do it. And I think that's a good point. And one of the questions I had for you that I should have been asked everybody that I've ever done a short-term rental episode with, I should have asked this question. What percent of owning or short-term rental and is hospitality versus real estate investing?
Yeah, it's funny. I've thought about that question a lot as as I've been, you know, owning my own short-term rental. And at first, I was definitely leaning more towards the hospitality side. But what I kind of have thought now is if you set things up right up front, if you set up your systems, I have a property manager too, which helps. But if you have the automated messaging and your house is furnished properly and you have good check-in instructions, the hospitality side almost takes care of itself. So I'm going to go with the real estate side and say that location is extremely important. With short-term rentals, like people care a lot about being in the best location. And so whereas a long-term rental, if you're, you know, two blocks away from a cool place, it doesn't really matter as much to people. But in a short-term rental, like you need to be in a very prime location. And I think that matters much more. So I'm going to go with that. I'm going to go with the real estate side of it and specifically location because it matters a lot when you're trying to get guests to book your place.
I totally agree with everything you just said there. It is key. Once you get your systems in place, and that's true with long-term investing, long-term rentals as well. I'm not so great at the systems for there. My systems for the Airbnb are really spot on. I have all inherited long-term tenants right now, and I can't kind of get them all on my level. But As I replace them over time, I will. Any big learning moments, either from the purchasing process or the setup process from your first short-term rental?
Yeah, I would say because all the properties I bought long and short-term have been long distance. And with the ones in Kansas City, I never went out there. You know, I just bought them long distance. I talked to a property manager, had it all set up long distance. I thought maybe the same could be done from short-term rentals, but honestly, the furnishing process, I think really you have to be on the ground to do it. So my wife was able to fly out a few times and we had help from our family who lives in the area. So that's kind of like a word of caution, because I know a lot like long distance investing is kind of in fashion, and it is definitely possible with short-term rentals, but I think that you have to plan to really get out there when you get the property stood up. So that's one lesson. Another lesson I would say is like, there's just some guests that maybe can't be pleased. So my thing usually is like, you know, if a guest, if there's an inconvenience, I might give them a little bit of a refund or whatever. And it had worked really well until we had one guest who complained about a number of things, you know, and it seemed like, what are they even talking about at this point? And, you know, I told the property manager, yeah, I give them a refund at the end. And she, I think it was like $25 or $50. And she said, I don't think we should, because they're going to be upset anyways. And she was right. They gave us a 4-star review. It wasn't bad, but they still gave us a 4-star review after we accommodated like every little thing that they had asked for, and we gave them a refund. And so, you know, maybe sometimes you just realize you got to cut your losses, and you're not going to be able to please everybody. But I think in the long term, you know, you'll be able to do a good job.
I agree with that too. And also what I will say about giving guests things kind of preemptively when they don't ask is, sometimes I think if you just fix the things quickly and you accommodate quickly, we've had recently ACs go out a few different times on guests, and we got them fixed within like 3-4 hours. And I didn't even offer them anything for that, because it's like, you know, I'm sorry, things happen.
Yeah, what can you do?
Yeah. And we got it fixed quickly. Now, if I couldn't have done it that day and had to wait till the following day or something like that, then that's a different situation. But I think in a lot of cases, most guests are reasonable. And I also agree where there's some people that are just, they're just never going to be happy. And sometimes I can tell before they book, right? Like if they ask a ton of questions, really nitty gritty stuff, I'm like, this is not good, right? And I'll kind of gently suggest that they book somewhere else. And that helps a lot.
Hard. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off a little bit, but that might be hard for newer investors to think about turning away a guest, but that's definitely something I learned, that maybe you do need to turn away a guest, because reviews are everything, and you need good reviews. So if you get a kind of a bad feeling from a guest and think that they might be the type of person to ding you for something insignificant, it's probably worth turning down that booking and, you know, hoping to get another one, or maybe even just leaving it vacant for that day or two, whatever it is, because you want to make sure your reviews are strong.
Absolutely. That's a great point. Have you stayed in a bunch of Airbnbs other than yours since you've had one?
I don't think I've stayed in any since I have one. I think in my life I've stayed in maybe two, but not since I had one. So, but
now I was curious.
Like, you know, it's funny because my wife had just recently stayed in one, and she was like, she stayed with a group of her friends, and she was like, guys, we need to give them the best review ever. Like, and then like, you know, they have the private note section. So she was like, let's give everything that you can in the private note section, but like give them a great glowing review. So yeah, you know, it's like solidarity from one investor to another there.
That's good, because I've heard the opposite. A lot of people, especially online in forums and things, are like, oh God, a host booked, I'm in trouble, you know? And I tell my mom the same thing. We stayed in one recently, and she was asking me, you know, what should we review it? And should we, you know, it reeked of marijuana real bad. Mm-hmm. And we were like, should we put it in the review? And I said, if other people have mentioned it, I would put it in the review, because it's not being fixed. We went back and looked at the reviews. Nobody had mentioned it. So I think it probably was the people right before us. And so, you know, we made that decision not to mention it, right? So it is interesting. It's fascinating to me that some hosts don't have empathy for their hosts, because I totally do too. Like, because 5 stars on Airbnb, if anybody doesn't know, that's like table stakes. Mm-hmm. A 4 is like, you're failing. Like, yeah, it's so bad.
Yeah, I heard somebody say that guests don't really understand that it's a pass-fail system. Like, it's not a gradient. It really is 5 stars passing, 4 stars failing. So, and it's kind of too bad that the guests don't really understand it that way. Like, maybe Airbnb should just do it as like a pass-fail instead, and then more people would just pass. I don't know, but it is really tough. And the difference between a 5 and a 4 is a big deal.
Right. I also was thinking maybe they could do it out of 10 stars. Because then because some people don't want to give you perfect. Mm-hmm. And then you still get a 9 out of 10, right? Which I think would be better. You know, then because that's a 4.5 out of 5. You know, now people just, they won't give you a perfect if there's anything wrong.
Yeah. I've had people give me 5 stars on all the categories and a 4 star overall.
That happened to me once too.
I didn't understand what did, and all the reviews were positive. No private note. And I said, okay.
I know. Yeah. Like you said, you're just not going to please everybody. It's just not going to happen. I do think a Superhost at 4.8 is doable, right? You can get 1 out of every 5 or 10 reviews can be a 4. So it can be done, but I just wanted to do that plug for anybody out there. If you are staying in Airbnbs, know that a 4 is really, really bad.
Yeah, for sure.
So we heard in your bio, Tesho, that you believe that real estate investing can be good for society. And I love this about your Twitter and everything that you post on there. And we'll drop your handle in a little bit here for people. But tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think there's a few ways. So I guess starting with the long-term rentals, I mentioned I was buying some older houses that were kind of beat up. So just the ability to go in, get a house that's beat up, really put some care and money into it, fix it up, and have it kind of be a shining example for the neighborhood. I think that's one great way that real estate can be positive for the neighborhood. Then I think, treating tenants well, helping tenants get connected with, so I think it's kind of more applicable maybe to long-term than short-term stuff, but with long-term real estate, you can help get tenants connected with maybe resources if they lose their job and are struggling to pay rent. Instead of just kicking them out right away, you can help them get connected to job resources, get connected to relief, rent relief kind of things. And then even zooming out further, I recently got introduced to this concept of urbanism and just talking about how the cities that we build and the neighborhoods we build just impact our lives so much from our health, our social, the diversity of our neighborhoods, the money in our pocket. So even just thinking about the design of neighborhoods, and I'm not at the level yet, but maybe one day I'll be able to kind of get on the developer side. And that's where I really think you can have an impact on society and neighborhoods and, really taking care to build places with people in mind. So urbanism is if anybody wants to get into it, yeah, look at my Twitter or just Google urbanism. It's a really interesting topic. And I'm going deep down the rabbit hole with that one.
Yeah, I love that. And whenever you post those things, I automatically think about 2 years ago, we bought a bed and breakfast, and that's how all this craziness started for us. But the bed and breakfast is walkable to downtown. So we live in the house and we have these accessory dwelling units that we rent out. And our lives changed so much from being able to walk, from being able to go outside of your door and walk to bars and restaurants or bike over to the beach or walk to the water. And that really, and there's a very long bike trail. You mentioned health. There's a 45-mile bike trail, a block and a half from our house. And it's incredible. Right now, I'm staying in one of my units, which is pretty. It's on the water, which is really nice. But that's it. You're in your neighborhood. If you're going anywhere, you're getting in the car and you're getting on US 19, which is a, big highway. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of stressful and it's not that fun. And so I always think about that, how much that changed my life and how our lives really revolve around vehicles, which is not good for the environment. And those first 2 miles that you drive in a vehicle are the worst emissions you can have. So if we designed everything a little bit better with those things in mind, we could be healthier, we could be happier, we could be less stressed, and it would be better for the environment. So that's what I always think about when you post those things.
Yeah. And I think for anybody listening, just think of what's your favorite city in the world or the best vacation you went to. And I almost guarantee when you were there, you were walking around, you weren't driving your car around for the most part. For me, it's Amsterdam. My sister lives over there. So when I went to visit her, I was this is an amazing city. And I wasn't familiar with the concept of walkability and urbanism back then. And I didn't know why I thought it was amazing. I was just this is amazing. I love it here. And then now I got introduced to walkability, neighborhood design. And I said, that's why it's amazing. It's really important. And I think a lot of, especially Americans, maybe haven't thought about it because our country is so suburbanized, but it's very cool. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. That's interesting. So I also wanted to ask you before, I want my last question to be, tangible advice that you have for newer real estate investors. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, just what's it like to be a professional soccer player?
It's great. It's funny because it's almost all I've ever known. You know, like I grew up playing soccer. I went to college. I was a soccer player. I got drafted straight from college, so I've never had another job. But it's really amazing. You know, you get to work out at the same time that you're actually doing your job, which is cool. You get to play in front of a lot of fans, and it's an important job too. You know, I have people, like, say I have a good game or I score a goal, people will message me, man, it was so amazing last night. Me and my family had a great time at the game. And thinking about that, it's just really cool. Like the power that I have, I'm here playing a game that I love, and it can really impact people's lives. So I feel just very blessed for that. And another thing with being a soccer player and an athlete in general is the schedule is amazing. So, you know, we wake up in the morning, we go to practice at like 8 a.m. and I'm done for the day by 1 o'clock. So I have a few hours in the middle of the day where that's where I first started really learning about real estate investing. I was able to finish my degree online in that time. I'm now able to like learn about urbanism and stuff like that. So our schedule is also really good to just expand ourselves as people. And, you know, network, learn different stuff like that. And I think that's something that maybe some more athletes should take advantage of, and they're not.
That's interesting. What's the off season like?
For us, it's usually like 4 to 6 weeks or so. And it's like the winter time. So it's funny because like that doesn't seem that long maybe compared to like NFL or something, but compared to soccer around the world, it's actually pretty long, like 6 weeks. Okay. Most guys might get like 3 weeks in Europe. So 4 to 6, the European guys are always like, oh, you guys are lazy. You guys have so much off time. But but it's nice because, you know, we always get like around Christmas time. And so I can go back to Colorado and see my family there. And usually me and my wife can get on a vacation or maybe take the kids somewhere. So the off season is good, but at the same time, you can't get too out of shape. So
right,
after Christmas, you know, I'm eating good on Christmas Day, and the next day I got to be out there like running sprints to work it all off. So
that's what I was wondering. That was my main question. Like, are you off, and do you have to discipline yourself, and is that hard? And, you know, that was kind of my question. I mean, I guess obviously if you're an athlete, you're disciplined. You got to be disciplined with sleeping and eating and working out and all of those things anyways. So maybe it's not a problem, but I think that
translates to investing well too. You know, like you have to be disciplined to be a good investor. Like you have to stick to, if you have a criteria for short-term rentals you're looking for, and you're not finding the deal for a few months, you might try to stray from it, but no, you have to stay disciplined. Like you have to know what you're looking for. And then if you have a system for how you manage your properties and a guest asks you to break it, you have to, you know, be firm in that, stay disciplined. So I think maybe the discipline that I've learned in sports has kind of translated to help me in my investing career as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Do your kids play soccer?
So I have a 3.5-year-old who he does play soccer. He loves it. And then I have a 1-year-old who he's just about to start walking. So not yet, but as soon as he's walking, he will be.
Are his shin guards like this big?
Well,
if you're not watching this on YouTube, it's like 3 inches. If you're not watching, if you're just listening, like, okay, they don't even have them.
I don't even think they could kick each other hard enough yet to need shin guards. So they could barely stay on their feet. They're like, they're more worried about like how to dribble, and like they play some fun games or practice and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. And this is like where they all follow the ball around.
Literally.
Right.
Literally,
like in a big group. Yeah. Okay. I vaguely remember those days. All right. So that's cool. That was really interesting. And I just wanted to ask you about, you know, being a professional athlete, because I don't talk to a lot of professional athletes in my daily life. But you did a really good job of tying it back to real estate, how, you know, and that's why I asked about the kids, because I think we see that with kids growing up. The kids that play sports are disciplined in other areas of their life as well. And some of it is time management. They have to be. And so I love how you tied that back to investing in real estate and things like that. So getting back to that topic, a lot of people listen to this podcast or message me and probably message you on Twitter. They're just starting out. They're just thinking about how to get involved in real estate. And they may be, I think in a lot of cases, are maybe trying to decide between even long-term rentals and short-term rentals. What advice do you have for people that are, you know, you remember what it was like to be learning. What advice do you have for those people that are kind of just learning how to take all this information, narrow it down, and then take action?
Yeah, so one thing I would say is just try to connect with people who are kind of on the same path as you, or maybe one step ahead of you. Like, and a great way to do that is local meetups. So just go find, you can do this through BiggerPockets or even Google. Just Google like real estate meetups in my area, or you can Google short-term rental meetups in my area. Facebook is also a great resource for that. Well, there's a lot of good Facebook groups in different cities. So go connect with the people who are in your city, in your neighborhood that are doing this, and they'll have great advice for you. So that's kind of step one. And then step two is maybe just don't overthink it too much. You know, should I do a short-term rental or a long-term rental or this place or that place? Like getting started is much more important than getting it perfect. You know, you can always adjust down the road. And I think it's much, much more important to just like get your foot in the game because the momentum will start building fast, you know, whereas I've seen people who have talked about this for years and haven't pulled the trigger on anything and they're getting lapped by, you know, people who just stumbled into it, maybe didn't do the best first deal, but on deal three, they're crushing it. So just get started.
It's so true. I think anybody who is a real estate investor has heard from somebody who's been thinking about investing for like 3 years, right? You're like, yeah, man, you could be trading up right now. And to that end, I will say my first rental was a single family home. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to buy a bunch of single family homes and go for appreciation. And I was like, you know what? No, I really want cash flow. So I kind of traded that in for a duplex, right? And I paid cash for that because I wanted as much cash flow as possible. And then I was annoyed. I didn't have all these leveraged gains. So traded that into a 6-unit and then switched to short-term rentals along the way. So I said that to say how you start doesn't have to be how you finish. And it doesn't have to be this preordained thing where you have to have it all planned out. You really do just have to start. And I mean, don't lose money on your first deal. But even if you just break even, you will gain in so many ways other than financial. You'll learn about yourself as a person. You'll become more resilient. You'll become more confident. And totally true, Tesha. I think it's about deal three where you can be really rolling.
Yeah. And even like you can do all the research in the world, but there's just some of the kind of nitty gritty details that you cannot learn until you're really in it. You know, I always frame it as like, you can get 80% of the way there. And I think once you feel like I'm 80 to 90% sure of what I'm doing, then you got to jump in because you won't get that 100% until you actually do a deal.
Yeah, that's about as good as it gets, I think, being 80 or 90% sure. Mm-hmm. So is there anything else you want to add, Tesha, before we wrap up?
No, I thought that was great. You covered a lot. And yeah, I just wanted to give props to you. I mentioned this right when we first talked, and just so good that you're doing this podcast for people and you've been so consistent about it. It's not easy. And it's just such a benefit like that you're putting this kind of content out into the world.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining. I know we've been talking for like 2 or 3 months about it. So thanks for bearing with me while I got through my backlog. So why don't you tell people how to get in touch with you? Obviously, we've mentioned Twitter, but if there's any other ways too and what that handle is.
Yeah, Twitter is my main thing. It's just Tesho13. I'm also Tesho13 on Instagram. So just follow me there and, you know, interact with me. I always love like messaging people back. If you have a question, DM me. Like I will DM you back, or tweet at me, I will tweet you back. So hit me up over there.
Can attest. He will respond to you. So you can follow me on Twitter at Adulting Is Easy. I'm also on Facebook on that same name. On Instagram, I'm at Adulting Is Easy Real. My YouTube doesn't have a name yet, but I will put that link in the show notes. Please, please follow that. If you want to watch it, you can. This is recorded, so you could see our lovely faces. And email me too if you have questions or if there's a topic you want covered. Or I've also been trying to get be put on my guest shoes and join some podcasts. So if you have a suggestion for one, email me about it at realadultingiseasy@gmail.com. All right, that's a lot. Thanks everybody for listening. Hopefully, Tesha and I have made adulting a little easier for you.